BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Have you been doing anything exciting this week?
Well, at the weekend, I did do a 10-mile walk with 80 other people.
Oh, hello.
Yeah.
10 miles?
But like that GP from Scotland who got in a car during her ultra marathon and then like took the trophy for third, I got in a car for a couple of miles and took all the praise at the end. So.
You got in a minibus halfway through?
No, just for a little bit, like a couple of kilometres, because it was a big hill. But it was also much, much, much more difficult than we were anticipating. So yeah. It was rocks and streams and squishy grass, and literally spent hours being told, move your foot forward. No, your left one. Okay, can you hear this stone? Try and stand on that one. Right, use your cane to find the next stone.
So did you be told? Because obviously I've seen you can walk. Pretty
yes.
well.
Yeah, no.
You know, much better than I can. But was it because the ground was so rough?
It was a really, really old road, clearly hundreds of years old. There were so many different rocks to navigate. And then between the rocks, there were pools of water. So if I didn't manage the stepping stone, I'd be in the water.
Like Vicar of Dibley style.
Kind of, yeah. And then, but my brother and sister were with me. We've walked many a walk before, done many a thing, and they've guided me or described things lots and lots and lots. And we haven't seen each other very much. Like, you know, there's kids and partners and we live in different countries. So it was actually a really amazing way to connect with them.
I've no concept of how long it would take to walk 10 miles, really.
So we started at 10:30. The main group got in at 2:15. I got in at 3:45, despite being in a car.
I am proud of who I am.
When I was younger, I was told I could be anything.
Being deaf, if nothing wrong, it's such a joy to be deaf.
Me, live in the Apollo, hosting!
I'm on the autism spectrum, so I don't really care about social codes.
They're bringing into the question, should your child exist when he's just on the swings next to you?
Wouldn't it be great if everybody had someone to speak to where you could offload all of your week's grief?
It's Access All. I'm Nikki Fox and I'm in London.
And 400 miles away in Edinburgh, I'm Emma Tracy.
This week, a huge fashion mag goes hard on disability. We speak to its stunner of a cover star, Sinead Burke.
Have you ever heard of eco-ableism?
Uh-uh.
Well, oh yeah. Well, as another big climate activist event takes place in London, we discuss where the effort needs to be going so that disabled people aren't dangerously left out.
Subscribe to Access All on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcasts. Well, I'm very excited because we are joined today in the studio by Sinead Burke. She is a CEO, she's an activist, and now she is a Vogue cover star for the second time. Well, the cover drops today, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's just dropped. I haven't checked my phone, which is probably a great thing. Let's not look at that for the rest of the day. But no, I am incredibly proud of it and to be here, and actually it feels really fitting that with everything this issue is about, that one of the first conversations that I get to have about it is with disabled women. So thank you for having me.
Tell me, Sinead Burke, what are you wearing?
Well, I'm going to do this in the guise of a visual description, seeing as we are all in this room and outside of it into accessibility. So I am a white cisgendered woman. I identify as queer and physically disabled. I'm a little person. I have brown hair that is kind of just past my ear. It's almost a bob, but hopefully slightly chic. I am wearing a silk shirt that is black with polka dots and purple and blue flowers to match the branding of the show. And then I am wearing a navy Dior Belle skirt and black pointed toes Ferragamo shoes.
I really hope that that description does justice to how you look, because you look beautiful.
Well, thank you.
I find hair descriptions interesting because I only know what very, very few people's hairstyles feel like. But I do kind of know a bob, but that was a beautifully elegant description, and it sounds like you're wearing fabulous clothes.
Thank you.
And Emma, one day, if you're ever visiting a farm and there's a bale of hay, feel that and know that that is my hair.
Stop it. I felt your hair already.
I've been bleaching since the age of 10.
It's not like a hedge.
Now, as we mentioned, Sinead, this is not the first time that you've been on the Vogue cover. What is different about this edition?
So I got to be on the cover of British Vogue in 2019 as part of the Forces for Change issue, which was guest edited by the Duchess of Sussex, Meghan Markle.
Yes.
And between herself and Edward Enninful, the editor-in-chief of British Vogue, they put together this incredible litany of women. There was Jamila Jamil, Jacinda Ardern, Ramla Ali, Francesca Hayward. I think Christy Turlington was on the cover.
Wowzers.
And at the time, I was the first little person to be on the cover of any Vogue issue ever. And I think as somebody who, you know, grew up seeing and feeling that fashion was important, depending on, you know, however you saw it, it felt like this incredible moment.
Does it blow your mind? Because just hearing you say that, you were the first little person to be on the Vogue cover. Do you not just be like, whoa, every time you wake up?
I think a couple of things, right? And Emma will know this because she herself is Irish. So I think, you know, being part of a big Irish family also, there's a great level of humility required, needed, you know, poured upon you. So the idea that I'm the first little person to be on the cover of Vogue doesn't really sit well among my siblings. And my mother's like, yeah, Grant, just fill the dishwasher. Thanks very much. Dead right. But I think for me, I guess it made me ask a question. Why am I the first little person to be on the cover of Vogue in 2019? Like, I am my success is the gift of timing. But also now that I have made it to that moment, what can I do about it? Mm. And I think for me, one of the most radical transformations was the pandemic and COVID-19. You know, I had been part of the luxury fashion industry advocating for change. I came home to Ireland to be based in Ireland for almost 3 years. Through COVID-19, we all had a closer proximity to disability, particularly those who previously identified as non-disabled. Mm. And yet here in the UK, 6 out of 10 people who died of COVID-19 were disabled.
Yeah.
In England, there was no sign language interpreters at any of the press conferences. And it really made me look at myself and ask questions such as, did the fashion industry become more accessible? Or did it become more accessible for me? So I set up a consultancy in October 2020 from my bedroom. And we still works from my bedroom. It's called Tilting the Lens. And we are now 5 people across Europe in terms of where we live. And the idea of it was to create this theory of change rooted in education, advocacy and design, where we could move people either from kind of awareness to action if their baseline was zero, or move people from compliance to creativity. Not just thinking about this as a legislative mandate and a minimum, but thinking about this as a real innovation opportunity. Mm. And 12 months ago, I got an email from Vogue, which said, hey, Sinead, are you free for a chat this week? Would love to pick your brain. Which is always an email that you know your life is about to change the minute you answer it. So set up a call and Edward said, listen, we're really interested in doing a disability focused issue. We don't know how to do it. We don't know where to start. Will you come on as consulting editor?
Yeah.
And not only did they take me on, but my entire disability led disability majority team. And I'll never forget sitting in Vogue House with Emma and Michael, who I work with, and all of the Vogue team, and us sitting there talking about how do we meaningfully make a photo shoot accessible? Mm. The first thing we have to do is we have to ask better questions. We surveyed every studio in London to learn what level of accessibility existed. We then ensured that talent was set up for success, to be able to thrive rather than just meaningfully or just minimally participate. There was a quiet room on set. Everybody could access lunch or teas or coffees. There was changing rooms that ensured dignity and access. And that's just a part of it. So for me, I think what makes this issue different is the way in which we think about visibility and representation, moving from something that is solely based on image, solely based on being able to see on the cover, to being in the room where decisions are made and consulting on those decisions so that it's not a moment, it is a movement, and that it is a red thread for everything that British Vogue will do from now on.
Sinead, how is this issue of Vogue particularly accessible to everyone?
So in terms of the issue, for the first time ever, Vogue is going to be available in physical and digital braille. It's also going to be available as an audio version. So it's going to be available
first in
physical and digital braille from the 5th of May. And it's also going to be available every issue for the next 12 months at least is going to be available in braille. So we consulted with deaf blind people, including the wonderful Haben Girma, asked around in terms of her access points, but working with the RNIB to make this a physical reality. every digital image is going to have alt text. It's going to be shared online with alt text. The video content has audio descriptions. So for me, it's those principles of accessibility. It's the ways in which hearts, minds, and skills have been shaped by this issue that I hope will then become muscle memory for everything that continues.
And then what about the people who read this issue and who read the essays by disabled people, the interviews? What are you hoping they'll get from it?
The amazing Frances Ryan interviews Selma Blair, Lottie Jackson interviews Ellie Goldstein. Right. I had the great privilege of interviewing Erin Rose Phillip in New York. And that idea of, I think for a non-disabled audience, witnessing a conversation between disabled women is incredibly important. And that this isn't just about people who are on the cover in the images. This is about people who are behind the scenes. In Edward's editor's letter, he talks about himself being disabled.
Yeah.
Language that he hasn't often felt confident or powerful to reclaim, and being able to talk about himself and his own disabilities, realizing that visibility and representation, yes, is about imagery, but is about boardrooms. It's around the finance department. It's in HR. Disabled people need to be in every room.
Yeah. And for people who don't know, tell us a bit about your other cover stars.
We have five. So I am on one, which is absolutely absurd and ridiculous, but incredible. So I am wearing a white T-length Alexander McQueen dress with the most incredible belt. So the next issue is with Justina Miles, who's on the cover. So people may or may not be familiar with Justina. Justina is a black deaf woman. Mm-hmm. She's also an ASL performer, and she went viral when she performed Rihanna's Super Bowl performance.
Ah, yes. Yes, yes, yes.
And then we have Selma Blair.
Yes.
Who many of us may know from Legally Blonde, Cruel Intentions.
Cruel Intentions.
If you've better taste than me, probably something much more academic. But Selma has been, over the past 5 years, very vocal about her MS diagnosis and how that has been impacting her life. And I think what's really interesting is, you know, Selma's career began in fashion. She modeled for Chanel. She was, you know, a brand ambassador for multiple companies. And now to see her proudly as a disabled woman and take up that space. Then there's Ellie Goldstein, who's an amazing British model with Down syndrome, who is the funniest and warmest person, and who was just at the beginning of her career and will, I think she's on a billboard in Leicester Square, Piccadilly Circus at the moment.
Brilliant.
And then lastly is Erin Rose Phillip, and she describes herself as a black trans disabled woman. She has cerebral palsy. Her power wheelchair is really obvious in this photograph in a very powerful way. And she's
the
most beautiful black silk dress that cascades down. And, you know, Erin has been advocating for systemic change in the fashion industry.
Sinead, I was going through your Instagram, as you do, and in January you talked about your thoughts for the new year. You talked about behavioural stretches,
which
is something we've started to talk about a lot in the office now since you said that.
For people that don't know, exactly what is a behavioural stretch?
So I share this definition with absolutely no qualification, but in the sense of how I have heard it and how it's been described for me. So the idea of it is kind of when you come out of your comfort zone in terms of the behaviors that are often your norm or what you are like as a person kind of day to day. So in terms of my example, when I was at Disneyland, the behavioral stretch for me was doing something that I usually don't like or try to step away from, which is like scary rides with a gravity drop. So that is one behavioral stretch, but it's expanding yourself in terms of your day-to-day behaviours.
Getting out of your comfort zone.
Exactly. Yeah. Feeling a little bit uncomfortable. So the language of behavioural stretches was new to me until I was in Disney World. So to give you the context, and, you know, please know that there's no humility in the next sentence. NASA contacted Tilting the Lens and asked if we would go to, asked us if we would go to the Kennedy Space Center in Florida to do training. And when in Florida, there's lots of probably things that one can do in Florida that they shouldn't. But we went to Disneyland, and there's lots of height restriction in the rides in Disneyland, which usually I'm perfectly fine with because I'm not a thrill seeker. And Michael, my colleague, is quite tall, and he said, let's go on this ride that I was able to go on. And I said, gravity drops, not really for me. And he was like, let's go. And if it wasn't for two of us, I definitely wouldn't. And I just remember going up the climb to that drop. And he was like, this is a behavioral stretch. And I was like, sure. But I think the behavioral stretches is very personally. I think it's about making friends again.
Yeah.
And I mean that really sincerely. I am very lucky to be surrounded by great people. I became and continuously become so comfortable in what I know and who I know that friends that I haven't seen for some time, or even making new friends at 32, feels really scary or weird. Like, hi, please like me, but also I'm in therapy, so don't like me because, like, I'm not a people pleaser anymore. And personally, some of those behavioral stretches, I think as a disabled woman, I'm also trying to move out of home. I'm trying to move out of my family home. I'm trying to get a place of my own. I'm trying to learn how to cook and fill the dishwasher appropriately. So those are big personal stretches. And I think the behavioral stretch that I'm learning professionally, my background's in education. I'm a teacher by trade. The idea that I would be CEO of a company and have to manage and hopefully excel in profit and loss accounts whilst also managing a team, whilst also working with this international base of clients and having to constantly be learning and trying to support people while at the same time delivering and creating change is a constant stretch, one that I'm reveling in.
Yeah.
But it's hard and sometimes it feels lonely.
My mouth has been open a lot during this interview. You are so incredible. I mean, your whole life has been one big behavioural stretch.
I was just going to agree and say that there are accessibility challenges on moving out of home.
Yeah.
And home, in some ways, home is the most accessible place because you were born into it and they make it like that. I mean, in the other sense, my mum was always great at leaving the Hoover in the middle of the hallway. You know, so it's the most accessible, but it's also where you are, the expectations of you are highest
totally.
As well.
Yeah.
If I get to buy a house, I'll probably buy one house in my entire life and I'll need to live in it forever. And I don't know the way in which my body is going to age and change.
Yeah.
And I find it stairs difficult right now. Can you imagine what it's going to be like in 10, 20 post-menopause? We'll figure that out. But yes, I'm really hoping that you'll all come round for some sort of very basic pasta dish
Sinead,
in time.
Are you kidding me? Is that an actual invite? Because
yes.
I will hold
I'm not going to tell you my address on air. Just
no.
But my mother literally lives down the road.
See?
Sinead, I will be there.
Listen, you're about 20 minutes away. I can't wait.
I will I will drive there. I'll overnight if I have to, whatever.
Now, Ireland is a different country, so you will need a boat or a plane just to be clear post-Brexit. You'll also need a passport. But
I just think, what would the young Sinead make of all of this?
I feel incredibly proud, but even more, I feel really energised that, okay, what's next? Okay, so now we've done these extra four things. What's the next four? Because what was impossible will soon be possible.
I think it's great that you are energised because I'm always the one who pitches in on Access All and says, but it's so tiring. trying to make change is so tiring. This very, I was going to say very special issue of Vogue. I don't think I should say that though, should I? This
depends how you use the word special.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Unique.
this unique issue of Vogue is on newsstands from the 25th of April. Sinead Burke, thank you so much for coming in. We love you.
Thank you so much for having me.
This weekend, up to 30,000 people are expected to gather in London for Extinction Rebellion's The Big One. Now, that's a four-day event with speakers and workshops, all to raise awareness of the climate crisis. Disability Rights UK will be at the heart of the event, giving speeches about how disabled people are impacted by climate change and what governments need to do. Now, today, we are joined by Dan White, friend of the podcast. Dan is from Disability Rights UK and is very much the person delivering the speech and driving this. Hello, Dan. How are you?
I'm very well. And thanks again for having me on.
We're also joined by Sam Little. Hello, Sam.
Hi, Nikki.
You are a guru when it comes to all things sustainability. So we're going to come and chat to you in a minute. But I'm going to start with you, Dan. What are you going to be saying at this weekend's event?
What I'm basically going to be doing is outlining what the actual effects are of climate change upon the disabled community and what the responses and policies that we've put in place should be to actually make sure disabled people are fully engaged in planning and implementing future changes for the planet, basically. I mean, disabled people will be the hardest hit community by a changing climate. That is without doubt. And so far, we are being excluded from these conversations, which include design and implementation. And then that is just not morally correct when you consider there's 1 billion disabled people across the planet.
And just give us an idea how disabled people are impacted by climate change.
The first thing really is disaster planning. I mean, disabled people are frequently unable to evacuate their homes and reach safety due to extreme weather or a climate catastrophe, leading to loss of lives. Mm. Disabled people are twice as likely as any other group, sadly, to die in natural disasters. Support networks are not able to reach us. Shelters are usually inaccessible. Early warning systems do not alert disabled people due to communications being inaccessible. COVID was a pandemic. It was a nightmare for the community. Two out of three victims of COVID had a disability. But as we all know, as the planet heats up and people move from arid, terrible places to cooler places, and so does the animal population, there will be a more jump of infections from species to species, causing further pandemics, which unfortunately disabled people will be more susceptible to.
I've heard this term, Dan, eco-ableism, being chucked around. What does that actually mean?
It just basically means what it says, really. We're already affected by a society and a world that we can't adapt to. So what's it going to be like in the future if everyone continues to be guilty of eco-ableism and the future is built to be green but not including our needs?
Now, Emma, I know you've been looking into this too. What have you found out?
In 2018, there was a heat wave in Canada where 61 people died, but a quarter of those had schizophrenia. The antipsychotic medication made these patients less tolerant to heat, but there hadn't been enough communication to warn people. In 2019, California was hit with a series of outages as power companies shut down power stations to stop wildfires spreading. And of course, we know that the wildfires in California are becoming more frequent. But when those outages happened, people who used ventilators and other equipment had to shut it down. They maybe didn't have it charged up fully because it wasn't communicated to them properly that those power outages were going to happen. One man even lost his life that we know of because he didn't have power to his ventilator and he couldn't breathe.
How is the UK doing when it comes to planning with disabled people specifically in mind?
It's not at the top of the charts, let's say, Nikki. So a big report came out a few months ago by Canadian professor Sebastian Jodoin, and he is a friend of the show. He's got MS and he's with McGill University. His report looked at the climate pledges made by countries in the 2015 Paris Agreement, and that required reference to disabled people. But only 35 of the 192 countries involved in the agreement even mentioned it.
Right.
And the UK didn't mention it at all.
Okay.
What I'm hoping is, because Disability Rights UK have built up this global coalition of disabled climate change activists, is to kick open these doors and talk to people. We've already delivered our statement to COP to say we need to be in the room with you, not in the side room discussing this.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, even the UN have acknowledged that people with disabilities are at increased risk of the adverse effects of climate change, including threats to health, food, security, water, sanitation and livelihood. So we need to be in the room. We need to be representing ourselves, putting forward these ideas and these results. There's no point people talking about for us. We need to be there with lived experiences. I mean, this is what the future needs to look like.
I know that also disabled people can struggle to be as environmentally friendly as they might want to be, which is a brilliant moment to bring in Sam Little.
Hi.
Because Sam, you've got some ideas, haven't you, on what disabled people can do right now. And I should mention to the listeners, if you don't mind, you've got visual and hearing impairments yourself, don't you, Sam?
Does that... Yes, I've got Usher syndrome type 2. So I wear a hearing aid and I use a guide dog called Ziggy.
Ziggy as in Stardust.
Yes. No. I want to take credit for the name, but I can't, but it's very cool.
It's such a good name. It's such a good name. Now, having new impairments, does it stop you from living a sustainable life, Sam?
Definitely. When I first started getting really passionate about this topic, through things like beach cleanups or Plastic Free July campaign, I just found it really, really difficult to get involved with Plastic Free July. One of the biggest things is going to refill shop. But my closest refill shop was a 25-minute train journey away. So trying to lug loads of glass jars while you've got a guide dog in one hand and you need to keep your other hand free And then when you get there, they tend to have quite traditional ways of weighing everything out. Okay. So I would just say, there's no chance I'm able to
this
do this.
This is not for me. This is
no, it's not for me. But so yeah. It has been very challenging over the years to be as sustainable as I want to be.
I want to talk about the beach cleanup, because don't you use those long things with little grabbers at the end?
Oh, I've got one of those.
Well, you've got one of those. But what's yours for, though? What do you use it for?
Pinching people's bum bum and picking up my pants.
Yeah, yeah. From the floor.
From the floor.
Yeah, so picking up stuff from the floor when you can't see with one of those long things, finding the rubbish on the beach. It sounds like a nightmare. Did you actually ever do one?
Yeah, so I made a video about it for the social when I was a contributor for them. And my husband was my litter grabber, and I walked with him and I was like, is that something? And he was like, no, Sam, that's a shell. We've got to leave that here. And I was like, oh, what about that? But I just really wanted to be a part of it. It was like, how can I participate? And it's why I've like never felt like I can take part in protest or like big climate discussion, because it's like, where do I fit here? Like, I don't feel like I'm part of the discussion. But I'm really glad I went along, because it made me realize how bad the situation is on the coastline and in our seas, all this pollution and rubbish. So then it was like, well, how can I influence this? What can I do within my capacity? So I started to look into small things that I could do. So at the time, I wore hearing aids with single-use batteries. So I just made sure I collected them all and took them to be recycled. A really simple thing to do. I thought about the different service providers I was using. So banks, energy providers, you know, ask some questions. What are you doing to be green? Are there better companies to use? And I can do that all from my phone. So that started to give me the confidence to think, you know, what can I do? It might feel like a little action, but it was very empowering for me.
Yeah, and it's all relative. You can only do what you can do. I mean, I get emails from disabled people saying, you know, I really want to be greener, but like I have a 15-minute visit from a support worker and there's just enough time to heat up a microwavable meal, you know, and have a bottle of water, you know, or use a straw, a plastic straw, which I need to keep going. And the old cardboard ones, they get, you know, they disintegrate. And that just people that are quite frustrated because they feel like they can't participate. And I guess that's the whole point, isn't it? What Dan's saying is they're not, you know, disabled people aren't participating in the wider conversation, but then also disabled people struggle to participate in actually making better decisions to become greener, because it's just hard.
It's trying to balance what you can and can't control and have influence over.
Amazing. Thank you so much, both of you. Thank you, Sam. Thank you so much, Dan.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Is Access All for another week. Emma and I will be back next week for pretty much more of the same. Excitement, obviously.
Absolutely. In the meantime, please get in touch with us via Twitter. We are at BBC Access All. You can email us accessall@bbc.co.uk or drop us a voice note or text message to the WhatsApp on 0330 123 9480.
Until next week, lovely listeners.
Bye.
Bye.
United Kingdom, this is Eurovision Cast.
Who's going to win Eurovision?
12 points. Go to
Ukraine!
We will do the Ukrainian people and the rest of Europe really proud.
Welcome to Liverpool!
Eurovision Cast.
The ultimate backstage pass to Eurovision 2023 in Liverpool.
Join Nina, Daniel, Gunan and me, Mons,
as we bring you all of the news, views and gossip
from the greatest show on earth.
Hey guys, I'm Mae Muller. Please come and join our Eurovision family.
Oh, wow.
Eurovision Cast.
Listen on BBC Sounds.